This is Daniel Kaner, the comic bard of Anglo-Jewry and creator of the off-Broadway show Jewish Chronicles, currently playing at the Soho Playhouse and shortly to be playing at the Santa Monica Playhouse in Los Angeles. And I am going to be talking to Rabbi Sol Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom, hello, shalom.
Shalom, hello, Rabbi.
Is this Daniel Kaner?
It is Daniel Kaler, the comic bard of Anglo-Jewry, a.k.a.
A.k.a. the comic bard of Anglo-Jewry. I don't even know what the hell that means, but I'm thrilled.
No, nor did I, actually, until I was given this sort of uncomfortable moniker by the biggest Jewish newspaper in the U.K. called the Jewish Chronicle.
Oh.
For me, the new comic bard of Anglo-Jewry. I wasn't even aware that there was a phrase Anglo-Jewry at this point. Of course, now I am extremely aware of it. In fact, they even called themselves Anglo-Jews in Scotland, so go figure that one out.
Well, see, I am the comic bard of Angry Jewry. That's yes. Been my title for a promo.
So I hear, I'm gathering this. Now, even just hearing one sentence from you, I can tell that.
But I am not angry at the moment. I am actually thrilled and delighted to be talking, ladies and gentlemen, Daniel Kaner. He is a singer, songwriter, a wit, a bard, a poet, and he has his own show off-Broadway at the Soho Playhouse. It's on one of my favorite streets, 15 Van Damme Street in Manhattan. He's got two more shows. You can catch him today at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern Time, and also tomorrow, Sunday, at 5. Although, if you are listening on the West Coast to this program, I have no idea why you would be, but if you are, you can see him at the Santa Monica Playhouse coming up next month in December. So, perfect thing to do for the holidays. But sorry, what? Did I make a boo-boo?
No, I was just agreeing with you. What a perfect thing it would be.
Well, don't interrupt me to agree with me. What the hell's wrong with you? Interrupt me if you're disagreeing, goddammit.
I'll never do it again, I can tell you.
You certainly won't. Now, the delightful Daniel Kaner in this show, it's called The Jewish Chronicles. It's a mix of him talking and giving anecdotes and stories about his family, a lot of true stories. A writer for Australian Stage, someone named Lloyd Bradford, wrote, quote, "The songs and stories are brilliant. The songs are comic, but don't go expecting Seinfeld set to music. They're also touching, tender, and affecting. If you're Jewish, and I hope you are, or maybe even if you're not, you're likely to run into your relatives in Daniel Kaner's tunes. They're personal, but the themes are universal." So I am universally delighted, as I said, to be talking to the one, the only Daniel Kaner on the telephone again. Shalom, Daniel.
Shalom, Rabbi.
So how has it been doing your show in New York the past few weeks?
Well, every day is an adventure. I think it seems to be going down very well. And, you know, there are sort of obviously differences between the Jewish narrative in Europe and the UK than the one in the US. But basically, such as, for example, in London, first of all, I tend to get a much more mixed audience with far more non-Jews in the audience.
Hmm.
And also, I have to do a lot more of explaining of the, you know, the few Yiddish terms that I have in the show, whereas in New York, I get mostly Jews, but they all know the Yiddish, even the non-Jews know the Yiddish, but I have to explain more of the English.
Yeah, no, I know, there's a moment in your show when you actually show a picture of a tefillin.
Hardly anybody recognizes what I have to explain exactly what they are, yes.
Oh, really? Even in New York they don't know?
They do, I'm just kidding.
Oh, really. I'm sorry. So actually, let's backtrack a little bit and tell us exactly what the Jewish Chronicles is. I mean, more specifically than its music and story, what kind of story is it?
Well, they're basically stories about my family. This is what happened was, I had a sort of midlife kosher crisis. I started looking at who I was and what I was and why I was and what was wrong with me. And I realized,
what the hell was wrong with you? I'm sorry I'm interrupting, but what was wrong with you?
I realized that I was Jewish. That's what was wrong with me.
Oh, yeah. Happens to a lot of us.
Everything made sense. And I had nothing to do with the Jewish world. So I started basically writing about, suddenly, it was like an epiphany, really. It was certainly not a career plan. Just suddenly I started writing these stories, well, about myself and about family stories that kept cropping up. And they all are very, very Jewish stories. And it's sort of, and particularly the music as well. Suddenly I found myself very naturally playing in quite with a bit of a Yiddish kite, because I'd written lots of music before this, but I'd never really understood that that's what was driving the content. So
which which is interesting because it sprang out of a divorce that you had after like 20 years of marriage. And then you go to a psychiatrist and you find the one psychiatrist in England, perhaps the world, that isn't Jewish.
Yes, well, that was obviously a bit of a shirt going on there. I mean, it is quite possible there might be one or two other non-Jewish ones, but
maybe
they're no good, are they?
Maybe the Schwarzes have one. I don't know, but then yeah, but okay, but you found a Jungian instead of a Freudian. What the hell?
Yes, no, this is very, and actually, a lot of it was to do. It's very much well, Jungian and also a Kabbalist, as it happens.
Wait a minute. Okay, I get it. Non-Jewish, fine. Not Freud, Jung, I get it. But he was into the Kabbalah?
Yes. Runs his own sort of maverick Kabbalah school as well. Not the Madonna one.
Right, okay, not the one with the red string. Or did you do the red string thing?
No red string, no anything like that. The only thing that probably was a little bit close to that was that he did take a sort of group outing of a number of his clients. Including me, some Jewish, some non-Jewish, and we did two things. We went to visit Auschwitz as a kind of a sort of group outing, and we also went to climb Mount Sinai as a kind of a group outing, which was, I think, somewhat maverick and unusual sort of behavior.
That's right. I have to say, like, my dear wife, Miriam Libby, who I've been married to for so many years, she has done the red string thing, and I finally said, take it out, it's a tampon! But anyway... Just teasing you there. I'm sorry about that, but you know, I make myself laugh. I have to make somebody laugh. But wait, you went to Mount Sinai. I thought you've never been to Israel.
Oh, well, I don't know where you got that bit of research.
Or you've never played in Israel. You've been to Israel.
I've never played in Israel, and I certainly hadn't been to Israel until 2 or 3 years ago. Although I do have relatives in Israel. I've not met them.
Well, we all do. So what was it like experiencing Israel for the very first time when you were 49-year or 48-year-old man?
I didn't get that sort of, oh, my goodness me, sort of feeling. However, there is something compelling about the landscape of the place. You can't deny that. And in terms of, well, obviously, the climbing of Mount Sinai was not actually in Israel. It's in Egypt, although you wouldn't want to do it now because you can't even get access to it. But I did a little bit of touring about. I did meet my relatives, which was quite interesting.
Oh, good.
That sort of shows you a side of, the problems with Israelis and their Jewish identity is very different to the struggle that I've been having. So my first cousin said to me, we like your CD, but why do you keep banging on about being Jewish? What's all that about? So that was a bit of a surprise. Partly awesome.
No, nobody has more self-loathing than we do. That's totally for sure. And I too, have climbed Mount Sinai, by the way.
Well,
it was the stairs of Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, but still.
Yes, well, the elevator wasn't working.
Exactly. It was very difficult. It was steep, I'm telling you. We're talking with Daniel Kaner here. He is the author, the singer, the cast of the one-person show, The Jewish Chronicles at the Soho Playhouse. So let me ask you a question. When you write these songs, and they are kind of personal, and they are funny, but also somber and dark, do you get people say, please say only nice things about Jews? Are you worried when you write a song like Bad Rabbi?
Slightly. Funnily enough, that did get me into some trouble in Australia. I know that you just read one of the reviews that I had in Australia, but there was a woman that came up to me after that, after I played the Bad Rabbi at the show, and she said how offended she was by the song, which is about, it's a true story about a cocaine-sniffing, whoring rabbi from the northern English city of Manchester.
I have never touched cocaine.
Dot, dot, dot.
Okay, yes, sorry, continue.
Not for you to admit on the air one way or the other. Nor would I necessarily be passing judgment, because actually this song is rather more about levels of observance and contradiction, but that's another story. But she said, I wouldn't have known about this rabbi if he hadn't told it to me, and that contravenes the law of Lashon Hara, which is, as you will know, Rabbi, probably law number 611. It's about the spreading of gossip. So I looked this up on Yiddipedia,
and Yiddipedia,
and it does say that if it's less than three people, it is spreading of gossip and is punishable by a certain number of lashes, and if it's more than three people, it's actually classified as news. So in a way, I'm doing a public service. Well, this didn't really please the woman in question, who was a convert, as it happens, from Russia. Russia, and as we know, there is none so zealous.
As a convert, that's so true. I'm telling you, it is true. But this rabbi was not a relative. This is just a story you read about this rabbi and felt compelled to...
Well, no, I have met his relatives because they came into a show one night. And
oh, wow.
Afterwards, and they said, we love the song. They bought several CDs, and they said he was much worse than I made him out to be. So there we go.
Well, I have nothing against whoring.
Well, again, I don't know what the Revenant would have to say about that.
But what about some of your other? What inspires you? I mean, you go through now that you're in that Jewish mode of songwriting, and you do write other kinds of songs, and we'll talk about that. But what does it take where suddenly the light bulb goes on? You'll read
actually,
10 stories in the paper.
I mean, yeah, Harley, and I know you'll probably think this is ridiculous.
What?
Prayer, in a strange, convoluted, mixed up kind of a way. I go, what do you want me to write about? And then something usually manifests. And for example, today, which as we record this is going to be Shabbat shortly,
yes.
I've actually started writing a song about that, about in some way, some part of me wanting to keep Shabbat and then can't be bothered to keep it, what all that means, because actually there's quite a lot of fuss about Shabbat going on at the moment, and I think it's a much misinterpreted, much maligned institution, in my opinion, so I want to try and express that in the song a little bit.
How interesting. I mean, this is... And by the way, you come from a rather interesting family, first of all. You have two brothers who are twins, right?
No, I'm one of the twins.
Oh, you're one of the twins. So
yes.
You're...
My twin brother, I call him the Jewish one. And he is...
He's Orthodox, right?
Yes, but I call him the Jewish one because he's actually sort of observant. Although, you know, our parents were observant, but he has become... even more so, actually. So he's the observant one. But then I have an older brother, and I take it that was what he was going to be referring to.
The other brother, this shocked the hell out of me. You mentioned it on your website. This guy's job, he's a man, first of all, and okay. he does the astrology column for England's Daily Mail newspaper.
Amongst many others. In fact, the only territory in which he's not enormously famous in his field is the US.
Now... All right, I mean, I do not, with all due respect, I do not believe in such things. I am a feces with Uranus rising, I don't believe in any of that. So, does he really believe it, or is it just, it's a writing assignment, it's a job, he makes shit up, and he does it well?
I think there's a bit of both going on there. I think he really does believe it, he's genuine, he's sincere in his process, but what he just happens to have able to do is has found a vehicle for an amazing skill, an amazing writing and communication skill. And he just has a knack. He's got the gift of the gab, and he also somehow just manages to tune in, somehow to be able to make people feel that they're talking, he's talking directly to them, when of course he's actually talking to everybody. And, you know, coincidentally, or not, as the case may be,
yeah.
People seem to think that it actually does apply to them, and they do feel like he's talking. He's very gifted. Anyway, as for the integrity and the accuracy of astrology as a pursuit, I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay. Also because aren't you his manager or something, or a business guy?
Well, I do. We do work together a little bit, and I am responsible to some extent for the look and feel of the products that he puts out. And somebody once said to me, "What do you do? But you try and make him stop waffling." Is that an expression that we use here?
Waffle, oh yes.
Waffle. And I said, no, it's actually my job to make sure he keeps waffling. God forbid that you say something specific.
Well, that's okay. Actually, I find that rather ironic, which makes it a waffle iron. I'm sorry. That is just horrible.
Yes, it is, but there we go. You carry on, Rabbi.
Oh, I do carry on all the time. I'm carrying on here with Daniel Kanger. Delightful chat here with the singer-songwriter, the cast of The Jewish Chronicles at the Soho Playhouse. We're talking about his family, talking about his life, talking about his show, a show that you have done in Germany?
I have done it in Germany, and when I was asked to do that, I was actually remarkably surprised because what on earth? Had they got the wrong act, is what I generally thought. And funnily enough, in the email correspondence, right up to the point of them sending me a contract, they never mentioned the title of the show. So I genuinely did think that they'd got the wrong thing, but I didn't like to put them out of their misery because I wanted, I needed the money.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. So what was it like not only performing in Germany, but as a Jew, being in visiting?
Well, I'd never been to Germany, and of course, in this day and age, there's an awful lot of Jewish people have been to Germany, and it's very, very close to the UK. I mean, surprisingly, I go up to Edinburgh every year from London, and Germany is closer than Edinburgh is, so but
that's how the Luftwaffe was able to fly over, yeah.
Yeah, and all that, what seemed like a long way away when you watch war films, of course, while you're watching bombers and they take hours and hours to get there and all that sort of thing. Well, of course it is. It's a hop, skip and a jump now, really.
Right.
And you can drive there under the sea and all that stuff, which is what I did because I had to go there in my car and take the equipment and the keyboards and all that kind
sure.
of stuff. Well, it was sort of terrifying, really, for first of all, because the language that I use, I mean, I've got a lot of dense language and lots of words. There's lots of patter songs and lots of very complex rhymes and all that sort of thing. And I thought, well, if English is a second language, that's going to be tough anyway. And secondly, I thought, well, they're probably going to exterminate me because that's what you feel underneath, whether that's the reality or not. There's always going to be that feeling. Anyway, I always feel that when I go on stage,
Me too.
Will they like me? And I think, actually, Rabbi, I think this is part of the, sort of Jewish psyche, which, funnily enough, the old therapist was able to identify for me, is that feeling of they hate me, they love me, they hate me, they love me, which goes on all the time.
Oh, yes.
But in all of us, is a very Jewish thing, partly because the Jewish people have that's exactly what's happened to them en masse throughout history. They're one minute they're at the top of the circle, and the next minute they're the absolute bottom. And of course, that's where we were in Nazi Germany. So I was very, very worried. And but it turned out surprisingly all right. And in the end, I have a bit of a sort of interaction session at the end of the show where people are singing along with my final number, and they all sing oi oi vey and they raise their arms in the air, so I get a normal audience to do. And therefore I had a full house of all these Germans who were all waving their arms around and going oi vey's mehr, oi vey, oi gewalt, and it was kind of surprisingly healing.
That's very cool. That is nice. And then they escort you backstage to a waiting oven, which was even more nice of them.
It was a waiting train.
That's right, to the oven. That's right. That's,
they don't like to do these things on the home territory. They like to export.
That's right. They bring you Poland first. That's right.
Right.
So let me ask, as far as going places and traveling, you've also done the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. For what, yes. 9 straight times or something?
Yes, although I didn't start off with the... I wasn't starting off doing Jewish shtick up there. I was just doing my ordinary shtick. And it's actually only since I've niched, if you like, where I've managed to eliminate virtually all the interested market. But if it interests a smaller part of it, which I now automatically get. So that wasn't a deliberately shrewd decision. It's just what's happened. But yes, I have done the Edinburgh Fringe, and that's worthy of a whole other interview. Don't get me started.
No, wait, why? I want to hear interesting stories about doing that festival for, thousands of shows come there. They all want to get, as you said in another interview, bums in the seats. How do you do it? And when, what are some stories that happened at Edinburgh?
Yes, well, I mean, that is basically the crux of every narrative. It's like, how do I get anybody to see me? And people do all sorts of ridiculous stunts in order to do it. And my stunt, of course, was to go Jewish. But this year was a little bit different because it coincided with the war in Gaza. And it's the first time that I've had to be sort of performing, or a festival has been on at the same time that there's been a major conflict in the Middle East like that, that they coincided. And of course, there was an awful lot of fuss there and lots of demonstrations. One particularly about an Israeli show. I don't know if you heard about this.
I have heard about it. Let me backtrack for the audience on this. At the Edinburgh Fringe, there were serious pro-Palestinian protests, a couple of shows cancelled, Jewish shows cancelled because of this.
Yes,
yeah, continue.
One, actually, as far as I know, because I was nearly the other, because I was in the same venue, and they certainly were causing an awful lot of distress for people trying to come and see me. But it wasn't just me. I mean, I had sort of large posts, and part of the things you have large posts. because it had the word Jewish written on the front of it. Now, you could interpret that as you will. Although there was another show, a Jewish show, that was on at the same time. Actually, somebody that you might have come across who has a... I think it played off Broadway for a little while. He was called... It'll come to me. Oh, it was called Circumcise Me. Israel Campbell.
Vaguely. And he didn't try to circumcise me, which is a good thing, because I would have yelped, but...
Yeah, well, I think he did. Well, that's the title of his show. That's certainly not necessarily the crux of it, actually. I think if it had been a Catholic's journey to conversion to Judaism, it wouldn't have been quite so interesting for people in. But the interesting thing about it was that he was... He's a convert himself. Nice guy. But he was dressed in the full garb, the full Hasidic look with the hat and the pays and the long coat and everything. Rather like you do, Rabbi.
Right, yes.
I can't see you because nor can anybody else because we're on the radio.
Although I wear knickers and depends, so it's a little bit different, but yes.
Nothing else, yeah. So, particularly on air, I suspect. But anyway, he managed to walk past these shouting, raging, angry protesters with their bullhorns and what have you, all shouting, free, free Palestine and everything. And for some miraculous moment, they were all pointing in the opposite direction. He just walked straight past into his venue and they didn't see him. Otherwise, it was like an English pantomime, you know, when they go, he's behind you, and then they all look and say, oh, no, he's not. And it was exactly like that. It was marvellous.
Oh, no, he isn't. Oh, yes, he is. Yeah, oh, excellent. So how did your show do in that climate this past Fringe Festival?
Well, there are so many variables at the Edinburgh Fringe because there are so many shows that how on earth do you know why somebody comes to choose yours? There's a guide program which is the thickness of a novel, thousands of these things in it. So it's all sort of a miracle that anybody gets to find you. And it could be the weather, and it could be this, and it could be that, all these different reasons why people do or don't come to your show. But I suspect, and my instinct was that my numbers were rather lower, because I don't think people are terribly keen, particularly in Europe, on the word Jewish at the moment.
Oh, interesting.
And I think, to some extent, what it's done is, it's, you know, the Gaza conflict this summer has managed to sort of remove... A scab that has grown over a wound which has never actually healed, which is Europe's favourite pastime, which is jubating, basically. So I think there is a lot of that going on.
Good for you.
Whether that really affected my audience, I don't know. Whether those kind of people would have actually wanted to come and see it anyway, who can say? But I felt it. When people used to ask me, you know, what's your show called? And I would go, Chronicles.
Just call it the I Love Arab Chronicles, and all the liberal media will flock to
right.
it.
That would be that's my next show, the Islamic Chronicles.
There you go.
Yeah.
Islamo songs.
When the audience. Oh, I was going to do a bad joke like you might have done there about the headcounts of the audience, but I'm going to leave that well alone.
We're not leaving Daniel Kaner alone. We have a couple more questions for this very talented and charming fellow. Kind of curious as to who were your influences as a musician and as a songwriter growing up in the 20s. George Formby comes to mind, but who else?
Well, George Formby, funnily enough, was an influence. Not necessarily, I'm perhaps not by design or choice, but my father, who, you know, had a taste more in the down market, you know, he supplied me with George Formby records that I listened to a lot. And I wish it had given me... I didn't discover Noel Coward until rather later, actually. But definitely a lot of that sort of English music hall, a lot of, you know, smart English songwriting, Blunders and Swan, Noel Coward, and all that kind of thing. Some musicals, but not very much. Gilbert and Sullivan, I suppose, all very mannered. But more, really, it's West Coast singer-songwriters, American singer-songwriters. You know, Randy Newman... And Et Al, really.
Randy Newman and who?
Sorry?
Randy Newman
and all.
Oh, Et Al, I'm sorry, I missed that, yes.
As opposed to El Al, I suppose.
Or Al Hurt or Al Hibbler, yes, exactly. Got it.
So in some ways I kind of bridge a gap because I've not really come from the theatre or the musical theatre songwriting world. And you can always tell a musical theatre song. I've managed to sort of be, in a way, I'm coming from the singer-songwriter world, but I'm taking a broader brush and I'm making a sort of a more epic picture, more detail than most singer-songwriters do, and telling stories in a song and allowing myself to just paint a bigger picture.
Is there one particular song of which you are most proud? It doesn't have to be in the show. Doesn't even have to be one of the Jewy songs that you do. But is there one song that you're like, oh, I really nailed it on that one?
Well, actually, funnily enough, there is one sweet one, which is quite short, but it was my favourite at the moment. What I tend to do is I have favourites that then I go off. But at the moment, and it is also seems to be a lot of people's, there's a song called Under the Table, which is about that sort of, it's actually about my grandfather and an aunt, and they had a it was a love that could, love that dared not speak its name, a heterosexual one, it has to be said, but all they could do was
wait a heterosexual love that cannot speak its, what was he, love with a sheep?
Yes, well, would that be called heterosexual? Must be another name for that, mustn't there? That would be within within a marriage, because that would be husbandry.
But
in this particular case, it was a very sweet but very unrequited, painful, I suppose, repressed love affair. And I seem to have captured that quite well in the song Under the Table. I was quite pleased with it.
Under the Table was great. And when people come to the Soho Playhouse, which you have two more chances to do, everybody, the Soho Playhouse, to see the Jewish Chronicles, what do you hope that they get out of seeing you and seeing the show?
Well, I think what they get, first of all, if anybody is interested in smart songwriting, they'll certainly get to appreciate quite a bit of that. But more than that, there's an emotional depth to this material, which is more so than you normally get from a sort of concert or a song, or songs, or even witty songs or topical songs or that kind of thing. It kind of has a lot of extremes, meaning very fun. There's a lot of fun, there's a lot of feel good, there's a lot of happy, there's a lot of deep sentiment. And I think what it is that you see triumph over tragedy, you see all the human condition with all of its foibles displayed, but you also get a moment of redemption. And I won't do a spoiler about giving away the end of the show, but you also feel at the end, yes, we're all full of faults, we're all full of contradictions, but actually life is quite beautiful, really.
Well, you do have a relative who makes a cameo in the show. I don't hope that's not giving anything away, but
yes.
Someone very close to
That was the spoiler, but okay.
Well,
I say that's all right. That would have been a better way of putting it. Yes, there is a relative.
There is a relative, and is that relative doing okay?
Yes, although who knows for how much longer. yes.
Good, okay. And actually, I was kind of curious, since we're talking about family and relatives and things like that, it's a fair question, if a little sensitive, since you have a song, a lengthy song about your parents' divorce.
Yes.
And now you yourself are divorced. Did you find yourself repeating patterns that your parents did without even knowing it?
Oh, well, I think we all do that, don't we? We all get to a point where we start looking in the mirror and we see our parents, not how we thought we saw ourselves. But yes, I suppose there is a certain amount of that. But I mean, in terms of are we repeating a pattern if we divorce because our parents divorced, I think there's actually, as nearly everybody divorces now, it would be more easy to identify the pattern if your parents stayed together and you did,
Good point.
I certainly didn't, it wasn't my intention. But I think this does bring out quite an interesting point, which is how do relatives, particularly if they're still alive, feel about their history being exposed in public, their dirty washing being exposed in public,
yeah. What
I'm doing. And that has been a slightly difficult journey, it has to be said. And my father, one of the songs is about him and his philandering at an affair with a woman that he met in the laundrette where he used to drop us off at Hebrew classes. He is fine with it, but my mother, not so keen. But interestingly, I once read an interview with Randy Newman, actually, bringing back Randy Newman, and he was asked by the interviewer, he'd written a song which was about there was a moment where he captured in the song about still feeling love for his ex-wife. And he was asked about, what does your current wife feel about this song? And Randy Newman said, the song comes first. And I thought, well, yes, that's all very well if you're Andy Newman, isn't it? But yeah, and therefore you can justify that in terms of that's what paying the mortgage. So it's slightly harder in my position, but not so dissimilar.
Well, I might as well ask, what does pay your mortgage? Is it the BBC songs? I know you're traveling. I was going to ask this about the Fringe Festival. I think you have to pay your own way and your own steam and et cetera.
Well, at the Fringe, you can. It depends. If you get enough, punters, and you're shrewd enough with the way that the amount you spend on advertising, this and the other, you can at least minimise your losses.
Right.
And also, it's a bit like a trade show to some extent because other things come from it. Now, for example, this year, this engagement here in New York has come from somebody seeing me in Edinburgh.
Oh. But
as it happens, the New York experience is a little bit like Edinburgh itself because that's also a loss leader.
Really?
The California one won't be so much. All these things, until you have as you probably know yourself, until you actually have an economy of scale, and that's in order to get that kind of head of steam going, to spend most of your budget needs to go on advertising, actually. You need, therefore, a larger space in order to get more people to buy tickets to pay for your advertising, certainly, whichever way you look at it, to pay people to come in.
It's a vicious cycle. So that's why I'm wondering, is it almost if you weren't helping your brother's business, would you be eating SpaghettiOs?
Yes, at this point, except that prior to becoming more involved in sort of running the Jonathan Kainer empire, I was making a very tidy living as a composer for music for television and film.
Oh!
Working in various other studios and with other composers and stuff. So I was doing all right, thank you very much, before that anyway. I've always done well, done okay out of music anyway.
I did not realize that, but because you want to concentrate on the Jewish Chronicles, you're not doing that at the moment?
That's right. Well, basically, I think two things happened. One is that there just weren't enough hours in the day. Mm. Something had to give. And I can remember specifically the moment when I was writing some music cues for a television documentary, and it was due in the morning, and it was still way in the middle of the early hours of the night before. And I fell asleep in the middle of recording something with the record button still on. And then woke up saying, oh my God, everybody's waiting, they're waiting in the expensive post-production suite, where is he? And I thought, I can't do all this, I'm too old to burn the candles at both ends anymore like I used to do when I was younger. Of course, we used to work round the clock in studios, at that point. Not with the help of any kind of assistance, of course. And so that's really, so in a way, there's a certain amount of, again, the shirt coming into this, which is that I'm able to subsidise all this work. It's just miraculously all works out all quite well, but I can do both now.
Halavai, and I hope that keeps going for Daniel Kainer. By the way, you have a website, correct? DanielKainer.com?
DanielKainer.com.
C-A-I-N-E-R. Daniel, C-A-I-N-E-R. DanielKainer.com. And you have a CD or stuff that people can buy there?
People can buy my CD. People can send me messages and I can respond to them in as witty a way as possible. And they can join my mailing list to find out where I am going to be next. And also so I can tell them about various scams from Nigerian banks that I think that they should...
Can I ask, where do you... Last question for Daniel Kainer, who is doing the Jewish Chronicles at the Soho Playhouse for two more performances before he goes off to the West Coast. Where do you see yourself in 5 or 10 years as a performer?
Well, I think this show is ever-evolving, so it will... As I write new material, I'll remove some of it from it. I hope this will keep going, although not necessarily with me pounding out the same thing every night. Secondly, I definitely am looking for more commissioned songwriting. I think that is my actual raison d'être eventually. And there's a songwriter called Tim Minchin, who's my nemesis.
Tim Minchin? Wait, this is the guy who did Matilda?
That's the guy who did Matilda,
right? Right, yeah.
And he and I are sort of, he got my gig.
Oh, well.
I want that gig. So I want the next Matilda, please.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, if I give you $5, will you write a song about me?
Possibly.
It could be a short song, you know.
Yes, there's nothing much to say. It'd be about 30 seconds long, wouldn't it? But yes, I could possibly do that. What you need is a jingle. You need me to write you a jingle, that's what.
Yes, something incredibly catchy and at the same time filthy.
Yes, I can do that. What you need to do is off air, you need to tell me everything about yourself.
Oh, don't worry about me, I can do that. Well, once we're off the air, I'll get rolling. But it has been a delight being on the air with the one, the only Daniel Kaner. Please go see his show, The Jewish Chronicles. Please buy his CDs and visit his website, danielkaner.com. And please wish Daniel Kaner much mazel and gesundheit. And hey, next year, maybe you'll be playing in Jerusalem.
In Jerusalem, yes.
Halavai. Thank you, Daniel Kaner, and shalom to you.